Please note that the information and advice provided via the Things I Forgot Were Good For Me podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed or substituted for professional medical advice, counselling, or any other type of therapy or professional advice. I do not provide specific medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. And if you have any concerns about a medical condition, please consult with your GP or other qualified healthcare provider. Please do not disregard professional medical advice or delay seeking it because of something you've heard whilst listening to this podcast. Hi everyone, I'm Rada.
And I'm Giles.
And we're your trusted guides for the Things I Forgot Were Good For Me podcast. The podcast that helps you remember, relearn, rediscover and be inspired by others about what might help you feel good on this journey that we call life.
And we're starting right now on our journey to discover those things you forgot were good for you and inspire you to remember them. So without further ado, let's talk about this week's theme.
So Giles, here we are for another week, another episode of the Things I Forgot Were Good For Me podcast. I hope you've been practicing it. We've got an incredible guest this week.
Our guest this week is Lindsay Uglow. She's an author of the book Leo and Friends, The Extraordinary Dogs with the Healing Touch. As a volunteer who developed the Animal Assisted Intervention Team at Southampton's Children's Hospital, she holds a certificate for Animal Assisted Therapy, Activities and Learning from the Institute for Human-Animal Connection at Denver University, and has, along with the help of her trusty team of handlers and dogs, helped more than 10,000 children and young people.
So I used to be a hospital administrator in my former life. Then I run my own business now, which is tiny. But my big passion is animal assisted intervention. So the reason I do it is because my youngest son had leukemia in 2008. And when he finished his treatment, like every grateful parent, you want to raise money. But eventually you realize your friends are avoiding you once you're on your third marathon and you still want sponsorship and you're doing all these sort of, you know, ridiculous fun. Well, they're not ridiculous, but it's ridiculous to keep asking the same people for fundraising. And you end up thinking, OK, we're moving away from it. But the big thing was that Ollie really missed our dogs and missed the human animal connection. And so did I, or Mike, whichever one of us was with Ollie overnight. And it was the dogs that kept me sane. And, you know, our eldest son had that connection with them at home. And then I just had a chance meeting with somebody from the Pets Therapy charity rattling a tin outside Sainsbury's, and the rest is history. So I started as a volunteer with my first dog. And very soon we would just meet and greet. But very soon I knew what I was seeing was more interesting than just saying hello. You know, there was much more connection there. But weirdly, it's given me more than I could ever give to any of the patients, really. But so I started to study it. I read everything I could lay my hands on. And the Pets as Therapy charity is great. You know, there's 6,000 volunteers there, and we are still members of that. But, you know, as time went on, there were some crazy happenings that, you know, just things that shouldn't have worked happened. So, you know, seeing an 18-month-old toddler that's paralyzed in intensive care, I was asked to go in to see a little boy. His parents had gone to tell school, you know, what the siblings' school, what was happening. And, you know, it shouldn't have worked. I was a stranger. We didn't even know whether he had dogs at home. But, you know, they just wanted to lift his spirits because he'd been lying, staring at the sort of ceiling tiles for so long in intensive care. And he was thoroughly miserable. But actually, all his stats just completely calmed and he smiled for the first time. And it was incredible. And, you know, I was there with the team and we were all sort of looking completely shocked. So I went away and, you know, read everything I could about it and eventually did a course at the University of Denver. So I I hold the certificate for animal assisted therapy activities and learning. And it was all, you know, really great developing it all. But of course, there was only me. So I had to build this team, you know, and luckily, you know, I've got three really good friends who own dogs that I've bred. So actually, it's really good. I mean, it's nice. It could be any breed. And, you know, I'm not being disparaging about any other breed, but it's nice for us working with children that they are all golden retrievers, because we're asking them to connect with whichever dog we've got with us. And in the same way as they don't get to choose the nurse or the doctor or anything, they don't get to choose the dog that suddenly comes to greet them. But down the line, obviously, if they're in for a long time, these children love the fact that they might be seeing the sister or the brother or the uncle, or, you know, because they're all related. And they collect, I mean, they collect the collection cards that we dish out and the stickers. And actually, you know, it is just fleeting connection is what lifts me, you know, in normal society. But I see it every time we visit. You know, they're not, for some patients, obviously, genuinely, they become very deep, and we then end up sadly supporting some, you know, even into palliative care. And those are very deep connections. But you know, things I forgot that I needed from a childhood, actually what I see is a, you know, a casual connection. Friendships and family are great, but they're a bit too deep sometimes. But, you know, anyway, it's fun what we do. And it's a nice, wholesome, uplifting thing to do. And working with children and animals is always a bit entertaining anyway, isn't it? But
Lindsay, can I ask you, it says on the back of the book, it says that I knew dogs could make a difference to children's needs and lives. What was that specific moment that led you to think that? Was there a specific light bulb kind of moment, or were you in a particular situation at that moment where you felt that this could be a big difference to children's lives?
Well, I guess it was when my son was, my own son was in hospital. So he was a patient. I was just a mum. I hadn't done any volunteering at the hospital then. And for me, it was, he really missed our dogs. Of course, he missed his friends. He missed life at home and everything else. But actually, the one thing you couldn't bring in to the hospital, you know, in those days, was your own pet. And you know, it, you still can't really now. And he, you know, of course, I would go in and I'd been out for a walk, or his dad would come and visit, and you know, and we rotated. And so, of course, we had not a lot to talk about. We, you know, we were trying not to tell him what was going on at home, and, you know, be excited about at home. But actually, when we were able to take Holly home for 3 days, our two dogs just greeted him very gently. They knew, you know, they sensed that something was different, and they were very calm. You know, he had a central line in. We were only home for 3 days, but he absolutely loved being at home with them. And I knew then that there was something that, you know, I was worried about taking a child home with a tube hanging out of his chest, with, you know, all those risks mm-hmm. involved. But actually, our otherwise bouncy dogs that might have, you know, bounced down the hallway to all the other members of the family, just gave him a gentle sniff. And you know, all he wanted to do was sit with them and just, you know, be in the moment with them. And they didn't judge the fact that he looked absolutely rubbish. You know, he'd lost his hair, his skin was a terrible color. He was, you know, he was just so, you know, pale. And you know, the boy that had been admitted a month before, when we went home for our first 3 days, you know, had changed very, very drastically. Mm. And you know, so it was that, I guess. And then you know, fast forward to running into the Pets as Therapy member who just introduced me to the charity 3 years later. And, you know, now I have the privilege of seeing, you know, a connection between an animal, not even their own animal, my animal, and these children. And it doesn't work for everybody. Not everybody likes dogs. Not everybody, you know, wants to be near them. And that's absolutely fine. But sometimes just seeing a dog from the other end of the ward, but seeing something other than the staff or the visitors that you're expecting, that fleeting, you know, connection of, oh, that's a bit different. What on earth's going on there? Can give people a bit of a lift.
I think that's so beautiful, isn't it? And especially in obviously those clinical environments where, you know, especially children and young people are seeing machine after machine and machine noises, and it's very sort of, it can be quite sterile, you know, even if the staff obviously try their best to make children and young people feel at home. You know, hospital is a very scary environment. And so, like you say, just seeing a friendly face of a dog or something different is incredible. And I think I don't think we'll ever really be able to understand scientifically, in inverted commas, why animals are just so incredible, you know, what they bring us. But they definitely bring us so much joy, so much presence. They are, you know, they are totally accepting of us, no matter what we look like, what we're doing, what kind of state we're in. They're always there. It's that kind of unconditional love and that unconditional life energy, I think, as well, which they have. Have you seen the parents of children and young people that you've encountered change also because of that? Or have you seen them reflecting back to you what their children have actually benefited from in terms of taking the dogs to the wards?
Yes, definitely. And in fact, you know, in my book, there's lots of little bits about that parents have offered up, which is really, you know, really lovely. And actually, in doing that, the strange thing was that I wasn't necessarily getting that feedback immediately. But of course, asking people if I could have their consent to include their children's stories in the book gave me the opportunity to hear what they felt had made a difference. I think one of the things that if you take the patients aside, what we find is that the parents, and I was one of these parents too, the parents don't want to ask too many questions. They don't want to be a bother. They just want, they don't, you know, they might not understand, but they do genuinely just want somebody to talk to. And especially in these current times where actually, you know, you're not allowed too many visitors on hospital wards, you know, it's usually just one parent and one child. We go in as a volunteer, we don't wear a uniform. So we look like, for the children, they see us as non-clinical and walking with a dog, you know, we are, and so we are easily approachable and we'll chat to them about their pets at home. For the parents, they will quite often have a chat with us whilst the child is stroking the dog. And we might just be someone to listen to about how worried they are. They might even just be talking to us about how, you know, they don't particularly like the food, but, you know, is there a better, just yeah. simple questions. Mm. And because we're there, we never talk about the clinical situation unless they talk to us about it. But of course, because we're not medical, we can only empathize and chat back with a completely lay comment. And actually, I think that's less intimidating in some ways for some parents. They will also talk to us about concerns. They'll talk to us about sometimes about concerns about the siblings at home. And because we're all, you know, we are all very au fait with the trials and tribulations of having one child at home, but maybe other children that they're concerned about and, you know, trying to balance everything. We are there as listeners for the parents, and we're also there as listeners for the staff. So the staff, you know, really, they really benefit from just having a quick stroke of the dog and, you know, oh, great, you're here. And there's a fantastic quote from one of the books that was on my course, which basically says, and I can't remember, recite it, but it essentially says the benefits of taking a dog into an environment are not limited to the patients. And actually, you know, bringing that benefit to the staff improves the patient care as well, because you've given them that lift. So for me, these tiny little conversations, and I mean, it might be only a minute, we'll quite often get a mum messaging us through social media, just saying, you don't know how much that meant to me, just you stopped and listened. And yet there are people, I don't want to make it sound like the hospital doesn't have that facility and has uncaring staff. They are genuinely willing to listen, but sometimes they want somebody who's not part of the general network and isn't going to be, you know, worried about what, you know, it may be a criticism, but sometimes mm-hmm. criticism is there and we can say, oh yes, but this is why. And I think, you know, it's just somebody different. And none of these people, you know, they're all strangers. We're all thrown together. And what we see are, and it happened to me, I was thrown onto a hospital ward when Ollie was ill, as the parent, worried parent of a sick child. I didn't know any of the other parents there, but within a few days it was, oh, is your child being treated for this? You know, and are they on these drugs? And there's lots of sort of comparison. And some of these people I'm still in touch with now, some were passing, you know, acquaintances. But, you know, every time you go onto a ward, there are strangers all thrown together.
That's so true, isn't it? I love what you said about bring that sense of humanity back to clinical environments. Like you say, obviously, and I mean, I've worked in hospital, I work in the hospital at the moment, you know, the staff are all there, they're human beings, but obviously they've got their own things to do. They haven't necessarily got the time. They absolutely do their best, but just having that sense of humanity, that sense of normality and that kind of sounding board, which like you say, is not related to anything clinical, but just as a reminder, a welcome reminder of the outside world and a sense of kind of grounding, I think is so important. I was recently in our hospital ward because one of my relatives was not well, and it was a small bay, and I did kind of ask the other patients in the bay at the time, but I said to them all, you know, would you like me to put on some music, because it was so quiet and they weren't able to walk around or to mobilize, and so I put on a bit of classic FM on my phone, very quietly, and they absolutely loved it. And I was there for probably about a week just visiting. But the sense of joy that they had from just me sort of being there, bringing in things like music, chatting about what was happening outside, you know, opening a window, they're all just really, really small things, but they make a huge difference to people's, people's mood and their outlook and their motivation to get better. And I think it's really interesting what you're doing in that clinical environment and thinking about how we can extend that out and how we can actually bring more of that into clinical environments to help people heal, you know, mentally, physically and emotionally as well.
Well, it's interesting you should mention music, because there's a new charity that's been set up in memory of one of our lovely little patients who very sadly passed away. But he's, you know, George's Rockstars brings music therapy onto the wards. And it reminds me very much of when I first started volunteering. I used to visit the adult wards. And the one day we couldn't go to the elderly care ward was on a, I can't remember what day of the week it is, but they had cake and concert. And the elderly care unit had, I mean, it's probably, I'm sure it's not working now because of the COVID restrictions, but they had wartime music that they would play, and they all had cake, and they had sort of tambourines and just very easy. It was like the children have in a youngster's school, you know, kindergarten school, but actually they were tapping these, you know, maracas, they were shaking these maracas, and the joy that these patients had. I mean, I only found out about it by accident because I went there with the dog, and the dog went. because, you know, we were asked to visit, but of course it wasn't a particular day visit. I picked up the sheet of patients who'd put in a request in for the elderly care unit. This was right at the beginning of my volunteering, and I thought, oh, what's that noise? And the dog put his brakes on, went, no, we don't go in there. but you know, it was a really great way of, again, bringing a ward of people to connect. And what we find if we go into a bay of maybe four or six children with a dog is that sometimes there'll be a special needs child in there, and the special needs child may not be verbal, may not be you know, able to speak for one reason or another. Maybe they're ill and they can't, but actually the smile or just even the acknowledgement. And what you can sometimes find is that actually some of the parents are very, you know, keen to keep everything separate. But a dog walks in and suddenly, you know, I'll be saying, do any of you have pets? Anybody have any, you know, reason for us not to come close? You know, please say, we won't be offended. We think like dogs, you know, you can, the dog won't mind. And, you know, maybe one of them will say just at the end, you know, just to the end of the bed, we just like to watch. But when we leave that bay, and we go on to the next bay, as we walk past, what we find is everybody's discussing it. Mm-hmm. So we've brought together, we've given everybody a reason to chat. And actually, that's really great for the parents. And, you know, for the children, going back to the patients, the dogs do not persuade or cajole. Everybody else has an agenda. Staff have an agenda to get their jobs done and the procedure done, whatever it may be. The parents, of course, have, you know, scheduled somebody else to pick up the children or arranged for everything to be just right for this particular test or admission. And so everybody just wants everything to happen. The dog doesn't care. You know, they're just there in the moment. And actually, that's like us. We don't persuade them. And of course, sometimes we can help just by distracting the children and, you know, involving them with the dog. And then whatever they're doing, you know, suddenly they'll do it because the dog will do it. So, you know, the dogs are mask trained. The children don't realise that we've smeared peanut butter inside the mask.
That's reminding me of my own dog, actually. I've got a little Cavapoo called Bodie. And I got a tip from one of my friends about peanut butter and smearing a little bit of that on the chew. And oh my goodness me, that works wonders, especially if I've got a work meeting.
If the children are frightened of anaesthetic masks, which some of them are, you know, if the dog put his great big snout in there, you know, of course that is a little bit persuasive, but the children will then, oh, hang on a minute, if he can do it, why wouldn't I? So, you know, it's all about, it's very casual connection. And, you know, I think the thing children have better than us adults is that they will walk into a bullpit area or a play park or a room. And if there's someone they might want to connect with, and I mean, it could be an adult or another child, they'll give it a go. Whereas as an adult, I might be thinking, I don't know whether they want to socialize with me. I don't know whether they, you know, or in the workplace, is it right for me to, you know, be here and being casual about, you know, asking them how their day was or whatever. You end up worrying about the depth of everything. Whereas, and fact, you know, certainly when I had, you know, and I'm a great believer in that you have mental health and physical health. So I wouldn't say when I had mental health issues, I would say when I have mental health, you know, ups and downs. Sometimes family and friends, if I were to declare to them that I might be, you know, having a bit of low mood, because they are my family and friends, they might worry about it for a bit longer than I actually would. It might just be passing. Whereas actually, somebody I might just greet when I'm out on a run or out on a dog walk, well, good morning, all I might need is them smiling back at me, and that will lift me, you know, or some sort of, you know, and even an older gentleman saying, oh God, it's cold today, isn't it? And you just walk away, and that is a human connection that's the only level I might need, because I don't want to be asked tomorrow if I feel better or, you know, if I'm feeling better today. I don't need the depth or the duration or the desire for it to continue. I just need, you know, a passing connection. And I think that's what children have better than us. I think we put too many strings together on everything. I think, you know, what I see in the hospital and what I see in a play park, you know, when I have a new dog to train, when I bring a puppy onto the team, it sounds terrible, I spend weeks at play parks because children make squeaky noises and they do all sorts of funny things and they run up to puppies. And I need these, you know, I need my next dog to be completely bomb-proof with children. But of course, I'm able then to observe how, you know, the parents will say, oh, no, you go in and you know, you go and, oh, there's a little boy over there, you know, and the children quite boldly will go up and say, can I play with you? And, you know, and sometimes they're not very, you know, not very nice, but actually they tend not to run back to their parents. They sort of work it out. And I think children have, and I'm not talking about teenagers, I'm talking about young children have the ability to not dig too deep and not require too much from anything. And I think that's what I forgot. You know, before I started volunteering, which gives me that not too deep connection. You know, of course I go home and worry about some of the patients, but for many of the patients, it's very, very, you know, here this minute, gone the next. And of course, you know, I value that, you know, I value being able to see them. But it's really uplifting. And I think a lot of voluntary roles are like that, because you can, you know, dip into and out of, you know, obviously you've got to, you know, you've got to give some commitment. But there, I think that, you know, it's nice to have no strings attached, you know, just greetings, you know, even if it's just passing in the street, or, you know, just no depth. That, does that make me shallow?
No, but, no, not at all.
You know, and I don't, yes, have deep relationships with your family, your friends, your workplace, because obviously you need those deeper connections and the deeper understanding. But I don't need to know, you know, what sort of a day someone's having if I just say good morning in passing, you know, and or if I stand aside and sort of maybe say, oh, no, you go first, because you can see the lift in me, and people are sometimes quite surprised. And I think that is what I've, you know, what I feel is that I'd forgotten. And I, you know, I would honestly say that I probably got too deep into my own worries and my own mental health issues. I mean, I'm not ashamed to say I have postnatal depression, but actually I think, yes, of course, you know, some counseling and some, you know, treatment helped me. But, you know, if I'm having a low period just because things, you know, are a bit flat, or the weather's affecting my mood, then actually I think, well, you can bounce yourself out of it by just maybe dealing with it with a complete stranger by saying hello. And if they grimace a bit, well, you walk past and you laugh at them. You laugh at it anyway, aren't you?
Absolutely.
Because you think, well, what's wrong with you? At least I'm not.
Lindsay, I was going to ask you about the dogs. Obviously, you've worked predominantly maybe with golden retrievers, and Leo's a golden retriever. What is it about that particular breed, coming from someone who's not that knowledgeable about dogs, what is it about that particular breed that works well as a therapy dog?
Well, I mean, to be fair, it's the only breed I've ever owned. So, and there are so many other breeds, and there are rescue dogs who are, you know, there are good therapy dogs in every breed. For me, I really like the golden retriever. I've always loved them. I don't think they are the only therapy dog that could be around. I think they have a very soft face. People trust them. And so it's very easy for people to accept a golden retriever. I mean, they have a wide open face that doesn't, you know, doesn't look menacing. And you know what? They look very, very gentle. The reality is, and I say this to every child that we see, especially when the nervous children, I say, you are right to be nervous. They're still dogs. And you know what? These dogs, when they haven't got their working jackets on, will still sometimes knock me over if they're going for a ball. So the reality is they're as reliable as your children. We say you're only as good as your last visit. And we used to say that when we took our sons to their grandparents. Dogs are, for me, it's about what you put in. So, and you could do it with any breed. But for working with children, what we find is that people trust them. They're also the right size, because it's not great to put in fact, the Royal College of Nursing suggests that you shouldn't put a dog on a bed. We can place, they're tall enough to stand their back legs on the floor, put their front paws on an Inco pad, and that protects both the bed, but it also protects the dog, because, you know, you don't know what's in that bed as far as, you know, cells or germs or whatever. And as long as the patient's hand gelled first, so they hand gel before and after touching the dog. So, of course, you need that size of dog. If not, you as the handler have to lift and hold the dog. Mm-hmm. Because one of the things that lots of people think about is that one of the reasons not to place a dog on a hospital bed, as well as the infection control issue, is that actually you have to consider the dog. So I mentioned earlier that, you know, we went to, by accident, went to Cake in concert, and the dog went, whoa, you're not going in there. But that's fine, because I will respect the dog's wishes. Now, obviously, if I had a small dog and I placed it on a hospital bed, the only right to withdraw would be a huge leap onto a slippery floor. well, that's not really great, and it's not really fair. Mm. Whereas the dogs, if their front paws are placed, they can just sit down so they can withdraw. Equally, you know, if you've got a patient who is either waking up or it makes them, you know, has reason to make involuntary movements. I mean, I've been with a child who suddenly started fitting. The dog will move away. The dog is way better at sensing what's about to happen than we are. Mm. And so I would say, you know, size is a benefit, but just, you know, people just tend to trust them. But, you know, equally, you can work with any type of therapy dog as long as it's given the right training and it's the right experiences. We do a lot of environmental training, so none of the dogs that go into paediatric intensive care have gone in there without having a simulation exercise, because it doesn't suit all of them. And we can watch the canine body language and just think, that dog's, you don't want to, you know, that dog's not that comfortable. And that's fine. There's plenty of other wards they can go to. You don't want to work with a dog that's at the end of its tether. And, you know, I don't know where the end of my tether is. So actually, you've got to make it so that the dog wants to come back in with you. You can't force a 30 odd kilo animal to go into a hospital environment. I have an issue with Leo in that he doesn't want to leave. So fairly frequently, I'm carrying said 30 odd kilo. There are numerous pictures all around our social media of, got caught again. And because he loves it there. You know, that for him, he's got me all to himself and he's completely adored, as are all the other six on the team. So none of them really want to go home. They all have to be bribed to leave one way or another.
Well, that's what I was going to say, actually, because obviously, like any connection, there's two or more parties to that connection. And so, like you say, just how we're hearing about the benefits for the children and the parents and the staff. Also, I'm sure, you know, any dog loves to go and meet other people, right? And loves the attention, loves the energy. And children have got such incredible energy and incredible life energy. I think that dogs really resonate with that, don't they? They really enjoy those sort of fleeting connections. So like you say, it's not just the child and the adults, but also the dogs, I'm sure, absolutely love that. And what you said also about, you know, that thing that you'd forgot was good for you was about fleeting connection, I think is really interesting, because when we talk about loneliness or we talk about connecting to other people, particularly during the pandemic, we always sort of focus on the meaningful connection. But I think we assume that meaningful means deep, sort of heavy, long, yeah. Exactly. Whereas actually, you can still get meaningful connection in a short, fleeting, temporary way with someone that you don't know. And certainly during the pandemic, when I wasn't going into London on the train or the tube, I was really astounded, because I really missed those connections. I was sitting there thinking to myself, why do I not? I just miss the energy of going to work. And obviously it's my work colleagues are there, but I started to notice that it was also that I wasn't getting those smiles from strangers on the train, or saying hello to when I went to go and buy a ticket, for example, or holding open the door for somebody. And I remember thinking, wow, these are people that I don't know, I'll never probably meet again. And yet I miss that connection with these people. So I think you're absolutely spot on when you talk about the impact of fleeting connection on our mental health. And I remember going for a walk during the pandemic once around my, I used to kind of do a routine walk when we were allowed out for half an hour, whatever it was, once a day. And I went the same route and I could see through the window, there was an older gentleman sitting there on the kitchen table. And I just waved, because actually, frankly, I needed a wave back. I was feeling a bit low. And I also thought, I wonder who that person is. I wonder what their story is, what they're going through, what they're feeling, you know, because we're in that phase of everyone is in this together. Yeah. You know, how can we help each other? And he promptly waved back. And that little wave every morning carried on for about 2 or 3 months. And it was really nice. And I don't know their name. I don't know anything about them. But it really lifted my mood when I needed it the most. And it made me feel a sense of solidarity and a sense of unity at a time when everything felt like it was very, very, very challenging. So I think fleeting connection is really, really interesting. And I don't think we talk about it enough. I've never heard that really before.
I only had to come up with a description. I was, Don't you think that when you get on the train, you, if you don't know, or on a public transport, or even, you know, if you go on holiday, you don't know the people you're surrounded by, but in your mind you have this little soap opera. So because you see them, you might see them by the pool, or you might see that person on the train, and you just wonder who they are. And actually, it gives you it takes you out of your thoughts and your concerns or your program of what, you know, what you're really meant to be thinking, you know, what either meant to be thinking about, or your brain is whirring round. And suddenly, you know, just your wave, you don't know what that man's history was, or what, you know, or any of it. And, you know, I guess I get so much out of the patients, you know, seeing the patients. Many of them, I only ever know for you know, confidentiality reasons. For many of the children, I'll know their first name and their age. And that's really just so that we can identify them, you know, should we need to identify them and write our notes about them at the end. But lots of them, we don't even know what's wrong with them. For some, it's really obvious. Mm-hmm. And for some, we don't need to know it. You don't need to dig deep. Now, obviously, if they're on the children's oncology ward, it becomes, you know, it is obvious. If they're on the children's cardiac ward, it is obvious. But for many, for day cases or whatever, we don't get the full background. Now, if we're doing animal assisted therapy with them and we're asked by the physios to help, you know, rehabilitate a child who's maybe had a big injury, we need to know a lot about them, because we need to know which side and what the dog is being expected, you know, what we can devise that the dog would be asked to do alongside this patient. But, you know, they are really in the minority. We've seen 10,000 patients. The team have seen 10,000 patients. I would say, you know, 90% of those are quick meet and greets, say hello. And, you know, some of them will come back in again and they'll remember the dog. And that's great. For them on the other side of it, they have huge memories. The problem with us is that we can't necessarily remember them when they come back in. But equally, so you were lifted by waving to this gentleman. Well, I wonder who got the most out of it. So you don't know whether he was in crisis one particular morning, or desperate for a connection, or was thinking, oh, there's that mad woman walking past again.
Yeah, exactly. Ultimately, I wish he'd stop waving at me, honestly.
Yeah. That woman won't stop waving at me. What's that
game? But you're right. We never know anyone else's story, do we?
It's just the soap opera of life, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And we don't know what's happening with them. We don't know what impact that smile, that, you know, handing someone a tissue, whatever it might be, we don't know what impact that has. And I think that curiosity to be like, I wonder who that person is, I wonder what their story is, it doesn't really matter, I'm just going to wave at them or smile at them, it is really, really powerful.
Yeah. And the benefit that we, the giver, get, you know, the giver of the wave or the giver of the smile, or even, you know, if you're in a car, if you let someone out and they wave and thank you, does it take you too much longer? You know, I think it's about just small, tiny, tiny things. And I'm no saint. I don't let everybody out, you know, at the T junction or whatever. And I don't always say hello to everybody. You know, sometimes I'm so wrapped up in my own thoughts. I'm not suggesting that everybody suddenly becomes absolutely, you know, silly about connecting. But I think, the whole thing about how children connect, they bumble along with very little depth when they're small children, and they don't worry about it. And I think that's the difference. We as adults get concerned about ourselves and about other people. And I'm guilty of it with my own sons. They'll say that they've got a niggly, you know, injury or something, and of course I'll then ask them, well, actually, you know, sometimes they don't want to be asked. God, it was only a twerk, you know, I tweaked, you know, my ankle or something, and of course, you know, I'm thinking, oh, is it something else, or, you know, how is it? But you know, they don't need to be asked about it, you know. It's much more casual than that. And I think, and I am guilty of seeking too much depth sometimes in a friendship or in a work relationship or in a, you know, even a family relationship, I might think, oh, you know, why don't they contact me a bit more, or why don't I have that depth? And actually, the relationship is still there. It doesn't need to be that deep all of the time. And I think my volunteering has taught me that I can still feel the benefit of you know, of joy from a fleeting comment or you know, like you say, cheery hello.
Yeah, that's lovely. It's a lovely way of thinking about it. And it's I totally resonate with a lot of what you've just been saying. The book's wonderful. When did you consider writing the book? Was that something you'd wanted to do for a long time, or was it just like a spur of the moment thing? Tell us about that.
Leo was nominated for the Friends for Life Award at Crufts by the Paediatric Intensive Care Unit. I'd done some work with a specific patient who was in the care of social services, and we had made a big difference to that particular patient. And the Paediatric Intensive Care team decided to nominate us. And, you know, I was wholly embarrassed about the whole nomination process because I didn't want it to be about one dog. So, you know, we made it so that it was about the team, because one woman, one dog can't do what we're doing. And straight after Crufts, I was approached actually by three people who wanted to write about the story. And it was very strange to suddenly be asked it, because I never felt it was my story about the work we do at the hospital. I always think it's, you know, the stars of the show are the patients and probably the dogs. I'm the driver, the cleaner, the facilitator. You know, I am quite literally the dog washer and the dog feeder, and have a very small role in all of this. But of course, you know, I have to make it safe, and I've done, you know, lots of learning about it. And it was, at first I said no, because I thought we were going straight back to work. But of course, then the pandemic hit, and we'd been making notes about our visits anyway, because we have to. So documenting our visits. But there are some visits that will never leave me. Some of them, you know, are quite genuinely, you know, almost harrowing. And some are beautiful, and some are real successes. Some are hilarious disasters. But, you know, they're all very different. And actually, after a while, I sort of started to think about it and just started to throw some notes down and look at some of the more difficult cases have got stuck in my head. And at night, especially if they are very similar to Ollie's journey through his acute myeloid leukemia, I've woken up at night, and to get rid of them out of my head, I've had to write them down. And so I had this sort of journal anyway. And actually, thankfully, you know, I have a ghostwriter, Izzy George, and she wrote about my journey. She obviously wanted to put, you know, where I've come from, because she thought people would be nosy, and, you know, my history with dogs. It was strangely cathartic writing and going through some of the journaling that I had done to get some of the more difficult cases out of my head. Because, you know, like medical professionals, you some of the things really, really are, some of them are so out of the ordinary that they really hit you hard. It all came together as a book, and Izzy's beautiful way of writing managed to put it together, not like a list, but because if I'd, you know, I wrote about the patients, and they are very much my feelings about the patients. And I was very lucky, because by writing about children and, of course, healthcare matters, we had to go directly to the parents and gain consent. Of course, in doing so, well, I had this outpouring of what it had meant to the wider family. And so I got some beautiful words, which I was able to wrap into the book from the parents, you know, and some of the staff. And it was by the end of it, it was a really lovely thing to do. But would I have ever done it without the pandemic? No, it's one of those things that came out of lockdown. And I think lots of people have done strange things in lockdown, you know, that they may never have done. And well, not strange as in bad things, but they've done things that they may never have done. And this is mine. If you'd asked me, would you write a book, or would you rather go and, you know, be on the wards 4 days a week? I'd be on the wards with the patient. It was a hard reset, wasn't it, for everybody? Mm. And we all did something that we'd never expected to do, you know, in March from, you know, in 2020. The script wasn't that we would all sit down and do different, you know, something out of the ordinary.
Mm, we weren't all baking banana bread. I certainly never baked any banana bread.
Not did I.
Pandemic. No. I think I baked a very apt, actually, very on theme for this episode. I actually could only find a Paw Patrol pre-packaged cake mix when I went to the supermarket in the days where there was no flour. So I that was about the extent of my baking skills during the pandemic. But your book, like Giles said, it's absolutely beautiful. It brings a lot of joy when you read it. And also, may I say, your social media videos are absolutely fantastic. And that's how I think I originally sort of connected or found you online on Instagram. So if anyone wants to go and check out Lindsay's account, there are just some incredible videos of the dogs doing amazing things I think sometimes even humans are not able to do. I was just going to ask you as my last sort of question, how do you get the dogs to do all those incredible things and take videos of them? Because some of them are just out of this world, especially with some of the, like you say, the masks, I think a few stethoscopes were on there at some point.
Well, they did baking as well, didn't they, during lockdown?
Yeah.
I did need a new hand mixer after Jesse dropped it a number of times whilst we were filming it. But it's for the dogs, it's all about reward. It's operant conditioning. So, you know, they don't always do everything instantly. So, but, you know, I mean, I can take an example of we've got a toy, which is a push button. You press the button makes a noise, and then you shoot across to the dispenser and the treats will come out. Now, that is a tool that we now use in the hospital because the children, you know, if you're trying to get them to do rehab and you want them to press a button, then they'll do it. Of course, they're then in control of the dog's treats. Of course, the dog is never going to complain about that. So the thing with training the dogs is that, for starters, we don't expect too much because it, you know, and we just practice. It's tiny little steps. And, you know, I've got four dogs. I've got one that will carry anything. I've got one that hates to carry anything. And yet he is really good at pressing buttons and really good at doing other things. So that's part of the beauty of having them all golden retrievers, because you can interchange them based on what you need them to do for that patient. But it's literally about reward based training, and also accepting that they are dogs. You know, sometimes I'm asked, you know, do you think we could get the dog to do this? And I'm like, no, I don't think we can do that. But as far as the masks are concerned, the first time I was asked to do a mask, I was asked to support this little girl who'd had a lot of surgery. There's a story about her in the book. I'm not breaching any consent at all. She had a lot of surgery over her first 4 years of her life. And she'd grown into a situation where she absolutely hated the anaesthetic mask. And so we, along with the play specialists, and hospital play specialists are absolutely amazing. These are members of staff who try and break down the barriers between the nursing staff and the medical staff and the children. And they do it through play. They have the most incredible kits, and we are within their toolkit, really. We work alongside them a lot. And one of the play specialists asked me to explain to me what the background was, asked me to, was there anything I could do? And I said, well, if you can get me an adult mask, I'll see if I can train the dogs to stick their snout in the mask. And as I've said before, we did it with peanut butter. By the end of the second day of training and peanut butter, I had four in a queue to stick their nose. It was, hang on a minute, I need my nose. The first time I tried to do it, I realized I couldn't do it with a pediatric mask because you can't get a retriever snout in there. So I had to go back to, you know, to start. But this little girl, I was desperate to do something for, and we met her and played with her, introduced her to the dog, started a bond with the dog. She loved the dog. She played with him, no pressure at all. We then went away, and it happened to be her birthday the following week. So the dog sent her a birthday card because mum gave me their address. And also we sent her a video saying that, you know, Leo was practicing putting his nose into the mask. Have you taken your mask home? And of course she wouldn't even get it out her bag that she'd taken it home with. But the following time we met her, I asked her, I said that Leo had forgotten how to do it. And I was really worried because he, you know, he's not very clever. He's a dog. Could she show him? So, of course, you know, at first she said, no, she wouldn't show him. Well, would you show me? So she showed me and she explained and she did all the talk that the play specialist had done with her. And then she put the mask on me. And then I said, but of course, Leo doesn't understand words, so you might have to show him. So she put her mask on to show him. Job done.
Oh, wow.
And that was really magical. And we then supported her right into the anaesthetic room because we had permission to for him to support her. So by the end of it, you had a slightly snoozy dog and very snoozy patient.
a dog full of peanut butter. Can we give your dogs a shout out, please? What are their names?
So I have Leo, Jessie, Quinn and Pollyanna. And the other three on the team are Hattie, Archie and Milo. Oh. So there's seven
beautiful dogs.
Oh, it's so inspiring hearing all your stories and all the experiences you've had and what you've been doing for all these patients. It's just amazing. And thank you so much for taking your time to talk
to
us today.
Thank you for asking me. Thank you. It's been really great fun. Thank you.
That's the end of another Things I Forgot Were Good For Me podcast episode. Thank you so much for joining us. I hope it's inspired you to go looking for all of the things that might help you feel a little bit better.
And hopefully we've inspired you to go looking for our podcast. You can find it on all good podcast platforms, probably some of the bad ones as well. You can also find us on social media. Our handle is Radha.
Yes, Giles, absolutely. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Forgot Podcast. So go and find us there. We'd love to hear from you.
Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again next week.